The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
It was on regular rotation most weekends. I don't even know how many times I've seen Stand By Me, but it's been many.
The terrible Australian, B. Jemine.
And he pretty much just yells out, "Misery's alive, misery's alive. Oh, this whole house is going to be full of romance. Oh, I'm going to go put on some Liberace records." I don't know why that line just killed me for some reason.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
There's some serious shit going on, and here I'm like, the f***? What is this? Why?
Mature themes.
King himself and also Mick Garrison, how they sort of stage how this virus sort of spreads and everything, was just very eerie and very unsettling for me.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 29 of the King Zone podcast, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I take a deep dive into all the film and TV adaptations of the works of horror author Stephen King. And with me as always is my very awesome King-loving co-host Super Marcy. Hello Marcy, how are you?
Hello, yes, we're back again. It's a lot of fun. Starting this podcast, it was like, I've seen so many Stephen King adaptations and a lot of them are worth talking about. And as we'll find out later in this episode, even if they're not that great, there's something still worth talking about.
Indeed. I'm excited for this episode as well, because the two films that we have paired up for this episode are, I would say, probably the two lesser known film adaptations that are out there. I think most people don't even realize they even exist.
I don't. I also think people didn't realize, at least with one that we're discussing, that it was a Stephen King adaptation. Mm. But these two films actually kind of link together with, I guess, the family secret type of theme.
Yeah, so. I kind of noticed that while we were watching it too, Marcy. Like, it's like, oh, we've done pretty good, like, pairing up certain films, thinking like, okay, these two separate stories, they probably have nothing to do with each other, but then you watch them both back to back and you're like, oh, there's a lot of common links between them.
Yeah, so like, either way, it's going to be interesting to discuss. But we have a first time and very special guest for this episode.
Indeed, we have a very special guest who hasn't been on the show before, but he is here to chat about the two Stephen King adaptations with us. And I think he would know a thing or two about writing books, because he is also an author, along with being a film critic. And that, of course, is Scott Tremont. Hello, Scott, and welcome to the King Zone podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Bede and Marcy, for having me. I was very excited when you approached me with this idea. I thought it was great because I don't often get to talk about Stephen King and his adaptations, as I'm not an expert, but more of just a enthusiast, and I wouldn't say a constant reader, but an occasional reader. But so I was very excited to jump the chance to chat with you guys about some King, even if it is these two.
Indeed. That's kind of like the conundrum when you come on the show. It's like, ah, looking forward to talk about Stephen King, but sometimes the movies themselves in question may not be the best ones that are out there. But,
well, but you know, yeah, as Marcy was saying, right, there's always something to talk about.
Exactly. But before we actually dive into the two questions for this episode, which of course will be a good marriage and mercy. Now, Scott, you're also on the show as well, because you are now a published author, and you have just recently wrote a book about horror called A Cut Below, A Celebration of B-Horror Movies from the 1950s to the 1980s. I was very excited to sit down and read the book, and I really enjoyed it a lot. So where did the idea of wanting to write a book come from?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. It was 9 years ago, I guess, almost to the day, that I started writing for Daily Dead. And we came up with the idea of doing, I wanted to do a column on old horror movies that maybe were flying under people's radar, maybe for a new generation of horror fans coming up. They weren't familiar with it, and maybe I could stump a couple horror nerds with some picks that maybe they weren't familiar with. Again, I wanted to do that whole thing. So I have about 300 or so at Daily Dead of drive-in dust-offs. And I've just always been obsessed with horror reference books, critical guides, all of it. Anything to do with reviewing or reference books, horror especially, also music. Just as a kid, I was just always into whatever magazine I had to read the reviews first.
I relate to that on a level.
Do you? Oh, yeah. I've always been like that ever since I was a kid. So when I had the chance to do that, I jumped at it. And so truly, it's for selfish reasons. I got to write about movies that I've always wanted to write about. And I always wanted it to be in book form. And some of these are dust-offs that have been refurbished a bit from the site, and others are brand new. But I wanted it to be, as it says, a celebration of B-horror movies. There are plenty of wonderful deep dive books, all the classics, your Carol, Clover, etc. This is something I think a little lighter, even though I somehow pulled the wool over McFarlane's eyes and got them to publish it. And they're pretty much an academic. My author copies came with a pipe, a smoking, and a smoking jacket. So I kind of wouldn't it be great? I kind of fooled them a little bit, but we have a great partnership with McFarlane. They're a great publisher. They've done a wonderful job with the book, I think. And yeah, it's been out for, I guess, just over a month, about 6 weeks now. And people seem to be liking it. So yeah, I'm super happy.
Well, I do love a good reference book, especially when it comes to films, because at least it helps. If you're a budding film lover, especially in the horror genre, it can also give you ideas of other types of films that are out there that you're not aware of. And I love the fact that when going through your book, before you go into your reviews of the films, you would go into specific genres. And I love the fact that you kind of set it up almost like a film festival. Like if you're going to do a marathon of movies, like you could, these are the movies you could do as part of like a 5-6 film marathon. Where did the idea of wanting to do that? I mean, obviously you would have to do different chapters on specific genres, but the idea of kind of doing it like a film festival.
Yeah, I definitely, that's the like feeling I got actually, like having a look over it. I'm like, ooh, these could make some interesting marathons and stuff.
Well, this is just it, right? Like the subtitle, A Celebration. I wanted it to be very celebratory. Even though, I mean, there is one, well, Josh Stolberg, when he read the book and his blurb, he said, even though there's some lovingly snark, there is, but it comes from a place of love. And I think that, I know that definitely comes across. I love these movies unabashedly, without reservation. We need these movies. You have to have B movies. They're what keeps horror going. They're what keeps genre going. They're what keeps exploitation movies going. Just the sense of filmmakers creating exciting work, or at least not boring, which is, after all these years of watching movies, the only deadly sin is it can't be boring.
Yeah, I agree. And I just wanted to add to what Bede said before, like having reference books are good for people who are up and coming, but I guess as someone who's more seasoned with a lot of films, like I enjoy them because there's always a chance there's something I haven't seen, but also different perspectives on things that I have seen. And there are, I'm trying to think, but there's some really interesting like reference books that goes into more, I guess, obscure things as well. So one that comes to mind is, I'm struggling to remember the title. I think it's Massacred by Mother Nature that Lee Gambin, good friend of the show, wrote a few years back. And I didn't even think about eco-horror as like a whole genre. So that book was like, I'd seen so many of the films, but then it just opened up like, oh, I get it. Yeah. And it's like that. I feel like it's that kind of experience. Even if you're seasoned, you're like, oh, I didn't think of things in this way. And so I always highly recommend people check out books and stuff like this.
Marcy, you nailed it perfectly for me as well. Again, it's getting other people's perspectives. That's what I love to do. That's why I love talking to people. And I think that's why horror fans love talking to each other about these movies, is because those of us who enjoy these films, I think, tend to be more empathetic, more sympathetic people in life. We're not your serial killers. We're actually the, more or less, we're more in tune, I think, with the good side of people. And we like to share that with each other. The horror community, I think, as a whole, it's very uplifting. And I'm finding that, I've found that over the years in the writing community, and definitely in the podcast community, as I reached out to so many people, Bede and everyone, to help promote this book. I got so many wonderful responses, and I've done so much great. Got to chat with some great people like yourself so far, and it's been wonderful. And that's not a side effect of it. That's the juice of it. That's the meat of it, is connecting with people and talking about this stuff. Because I don't have, in like my personal bubble, I don't have a lot of people that are like super into it that want to talk about it. My wife watches horror with me and enjoys it, and we can talk about it. But other than that, unless I'm getting together with the Calgary Horror Nerd Collective, which is hard to do on a regular basis, my online friends are where I come. So
I mean, if you're anything like Bede and I, we make our close-knit friends watch all the weird shit that we enjoy, and they end up liking it because I think we have good taste that way.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, we also get to indulge with the people that we know online who we'd love to hang out with in person, but everyone lives everywhere. But at least in our circle, we're like, have you seen this movie? Well, let's watch it. I mean,
yeah, and it's become so much easier, right, to do that now.
Yeah,
with streaming, etc., and online and watch parties, and it's so much back in the 90s, you might have to send away from the back of Fangoria magazine to get a catalog for a company in Japan to get videotapes made of, and this is how, and this
the tape trading days.
These were your lines of communication back then. So now, to just be able to do a Zoom call with someone and just say, hey, have you seen this, or to talk about a movie that we've collectively seen and that we can discuss, much like the two gems coming up.
Yes. I was going to add, it helps, I guess, more recently that we've had some really cool screenings in our city, and we've invited our friends along, and we saw the likes of Sleepwalkers.
Yeah.
I'm trying to go back. We watched the original Fright Night on the big screen. Recently it was Monkey Shines, and it's great to kind of just bring people who haven't seen the movies or maybe don't remember them, and we get to see them on the big screen. And I do love that we have this culture in our city that older movies will screen at cinemas, and there's a lot of like love and programming for these things. So I think we're very lucky, and we can force our friends into our weird.
We do have a couple here in Calgary as well. We do have a couple theaters that do cater to repertory stuff. We do have a horror society here in Calgary. It's small, but strong. We have coming up on our 11th or 12th annual Calgary Horror Con, which grows a little bit bigger every year. We're having Mommies with the Maggots now is coming to visit us this June. The actress from Evil Dead Rise and a whole host of others. So I'm hoping, I'm actually in the process of setting up, hopefully that I can sell there as well as help out and do and host some events and whatnot. But I'm hoping if I do that, I can get a cheap table.
Well, we'll have to check there.
Push some pages.
We'll have to check it out, post some things online. And I mean, I'm so jealous because I wish we had like horror centric like conventions and stuff here. I think we might have to start doing it, Bede.
Yeah, I think we might have to.
We went to like one. There was one.
Is it that there just isn't a lot? Or
no, I mean, at least here, because I guess Australia is like such a minor population despite how big the country is. But I guess horror.
Same. Hello.
True. I mean, if anything, Canada relates, right?
Yeah.
That's why Aussies and Canadians are like best friends. But I just don't think anybody has just like thought of maybe having like a yearly horror themed convention. Like we have the usual pop culture related type ones that we get like 2, 3, 4 in the city each year, but nothing like specifically horror focused. We had one like 10 years ago or something that we went to, but it would be fun. But I think there is like a Melbourne Horror Society and they do screenings once a month, but I don't think like there's not like a convention or something like that, but maybe we have to talk to people, Bede. Maybe we do.
We might have to, Marcy, or maybe even talk to one of the cinemas and program a little film festival based on Scott's book.
Oh, hello.
Well, that's what I mean. I'm like looking, because I'm looking back over your book right now, because like I said, you've done each chapter like a little festival, but I love the, instead of giving a specific like subgenre, like zombie slashes, you're a bit more creative with each chapter. Like, for example, the B sci-fi movies you described as Duct Tape and Stardust. And one of my favorites, of course, is the Canadian horror section, which you put down as Back Bacon Bloodbath.
Yeah. Like I said, at the end of the day, I just can't take it too seriously. Mm. I love it and I take it seriously, but I can't take it seriously.
Well, you're our kind of people.
I'm not going to lose any friendships over a movie. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. And you know what? At the end of the day, you get either burnt or buried. So I don't know. Enjoy the movies that you enjoy and leave people alone if it ain't the same thing. So
Exactly.
But I guess before we wrap up on our conversation of Cut Below, Scott, now, out of all the chapters in your book, this is my question for you, which is your favorite festival out of all of them? Like, if you had to organize your own little marathon of films with friends out of only the chapters in your book, which would be the festival you would play for friends?
WTF, what the film?
Yes.
My favorite kind of movie.
And I love the fact, and I love what you chose, because you got The Baby, you have Phantom of the Paradise, Eaten Alive, Hollywood Meat Cleaver Massacre, and of course a movie that is I saw in the cinema many years ago, and it's probably one of the most batshit insane films I've ever seen, and that's The Manitou.
No! In the theater?
Yeah, I think they did it as a double bill, because this was one of the cinemas here used to do, like, double bills, and I think trying to remember what the other film was that they played, but I keep thinking it might have been The Devil Rides Out, because that they would, but yeah, they did play The Manitou, and I like, what the hell's The Manitou? I've never heard of this movie. And then I went and watched it, and my mind was blown. And then I found that afterwards it was directed by the director of Grizzly and Day of the Animals, so it says so much.
I mean, as a fan of Day of the Animals, we know this. I need to see this movie. Thank you, Scott's book.
I think I have two Girdlers in the book, Grizzly and the Manitou. He was one of my favorite B movie directors because I think he was one of those guys who you actually saw him get better with each movie. If you start back with Three on a Meat Hook, which is just terrible.
It's terrible.
It's awful. It's awful.
The title is more entertaining than the movie.
The title's awesome. The title's fantastic. Like the marketing for the movie, it just needed a movie.
That's it. It did. It needed an actual decent movie.
By the time he got to Grizzly, he was well greased, and Grizzly is just one of my favorite Jaws ripoffs. And that could have been its own festival in itself. But I have two of my favorite ones in Chapter One, The Animal Killed Him. So I got away with him. But yeah, there's I had to have a couple Girdlers in there. And by the time he got to the Manitou, he was 30 years old, 6 years. He had done 9 films. And each was better than the last. And the Manitou is how that got printed onto film and shown to people, I don't understand, but I'm glad that there is film stock of Susan Strasberg on a hospital bed in outer space, topless, shooting laser beams out of her hands at a little person, Micmac, 400-year-old demon.
This sounds like a fever dream I might have.
It literally is.
Maybe the three of us should get back together and do a commentary for this.
I think we need to. And also,
I'm so in.
But yeah, I mean, I have to say, Scott, your book is a great reference book. I really enjoyed it a lot. And I think, Marcy, at some point we may have to do a festival out of this book and do a marathon one of these days. And
it might have to be a tradition.
Yes. Let's just show all of our friends the What the Film section and just watch them. But
yeah. I could traumatize a couple people. So go for it, please. And report back.
Exactly. But Scott, I guess now that we're wrapping up our discussion on your book, where can people buy your book if they're interested in getting it?
If you can't find it at your favorite bookseller, please ask them to bring it in. As I've said, McFarland is more of an academic press, so they sell mainly to institutions and libraries as such. So they're not heavily retail. So if you go to a store, they don't have it, ask them to bring it in and they can order it for you. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy.
Awesome. Everyone has to buy it mainly because you write about Marcy's favorite zombie film, Burial Ground, in it as well.
Oh, the things I could say about that movie, but
indeed,
we've done the commentary for that. So
exactly. But I guess we could move right along to the rest of the episode. And like I said before, on this episode of the show, we're going to be talking about 2 Stephen King film adaptations that came out in 2014, which of course are A Good Marriage and Mercy. And we might as well get straight into it and talk about the very first one. And I sort of looked at like which came first, and I realized both these movies were released a few days of each other.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Because A Good Marriage came out in the US on the 3rd of October, while Mercy was released on DVD on October 7th, so literally 4 days apart. So so we might as well get
good strategic dump.
So we'll get straight to our very first film, which of course is A Good Marriage.
Thank everybody for coming tonight. Through hard work and lots of love, my parents have created something very rare. A good marriage.
When will you be back?
It depends on the traffic.
Drive safe. Bye. Marjorie Duvall moved here after her divorce 5 years ago. Miss Duvall's body was discovered early this morning.
Elements of the crime suggest that it was the work of the notorious serial killer who calls himself Beatty.
You okay?
Yes. You're so lucky. I don't know how you do it.
And neither do I.
This is a lovely home.
What may I do for you, Detective Ramsey?
You just had to look, didn't you?
Darcy!
And you know what they say. Two can keep a secret if one of them is dead.
Which was directed by Peter Askin, written by Stephen King, based on his novella A Good Marriage, which is from his novella collection Full Dark, No Stars. And also, Marcy, two other films have been adapted from this book. One we have already covered on this show, which of course is 1922, and a future one we'll be talking about, which is Big Driver. So look forward to our episode on Big Driver very soon. But this film stars Joan Allen, Anthony LaPaglia, Kristen Connolly, and Stephen Lang. And the plot summary for this film is, after 25 years of a good marriage, what will Darcy do once she discovers her husband's sinister secret? Now, Marcy. Now, I understand, Marcy, this is actually your second time watching the film.
Yes.
Tell us your thoughts on A Good Marriage.
Yeah, originally I was sent a screener when it came out to review. So I saw it way back then. And actually, on my rewatch, I think I liked it a little bit better than my initial watch, as my score has now gone up a little bit. Like, I think there is actually a lot of good, excuse the pun, in A Good Marriage. I think it's bogged down by a few things, and I don't necessarily think it's the psychological aspect, but I think the way that some of the relationship between the husband and wife just doesn't quite work. And I don't think that's down to the actors. I think that might be down to a bit of the script and direction. It is like an interesting story about finding out like your husband is a serial killer and you never picked up the signs and duh. But the fact that like he finds out she knows pretty quickly, I think, brings it down a little bit. There's not a lot of suspense with, I guess, keeping this secret. And then I think it kind of gets muddled and loses things a little bit. But I think what stops it from being, a total failure, but I think the performances are actually really good. And nobody asked Stephen Lang to go as hard as he does, but he makes like that final scene in the hospital like very memorable. But yeah, so I'm still mixed on it, but I think it was maybe a little better than I initially gave it credit for, but I still see the issues within the film. I think it's possible that this could be a great film. I'm just not sure it got there with this.
And Scott, your thoughts on A Good Marriage?
I almost openly wept when it was over because the premise is so fantastic and the execution is so lackluster. I think the idea is great. I think the potential for great suspense is there in the premise, built in, baked in. But as you said, Marcy, once that reveal is done very early in the movie, nothing is done with that and nothing is expanded on that. And I hate to be the kind of person who's just picks apart a movie and says, I would have liked to have seen them do this, or would have liked to have seen them do that. The movie you get is the movie you get. So, okay, fine. Honestly, I've seen more suspense in like an Unsolved Mystery episode. And even with that reveal early, I think they still could have invested a lot of suspense into it by, for instance, having her play around with him, toy with him, because now they have this between
them. Yeah, they don't. They don't really explore that, like a power dynamic that once she knows, like she doesn't really mess with him or anything like that. And I think in turn, the interactions feel awkward and they shouldn't be.
Yeah, because you're not clear as to what she's planning to do. And you're just not invested enough in what she's planning to do. And I couldn't agree with you more about the performances, though. Joan Allen, I think, is terrific. For me, LaPaglia, a little less so. I don't buy him as a villain at all, but I found Joan Allen carries a lot of this movie on. She has a lot of the heavy lifting, I think, just because the script is not giving them a lot to do.
Well, this was my first time watching the film. So when I read the premise, I had a bit of an idea what to expect from this film going in. I thought she's going to discover that her husband is a serial killer. Then basically it's going to be like her trying to hide the fact that she knows from her husband. And yeah, the suspense,
you kind of think you'd get a cat and mouse game or something out of it, right?
Yeah, well, that's my initial thought. But then when at the end of the first act, when he actually reveals, like, oh, he knows that she found his hiding spot, I just thought, oh, that I was not expecting that early in the film. But then I just started finding it interesting. I think as a whole, the film is a mixed bag, but I liked how Stephen King kind of subverts your expectations for this type of story. And having that reveal so early and him having that conversation with Darcy at the end of the first act, very surprising for me, because this is a woman who's deeply in love with her husband. And then once she finds the truth about it, but her whole world is pretty much rocked and she doesn't know how to deal with it. And now that he knows that she knows, from there, it's just basically like she is in denial about the whole thing and basically tells him that, all right, you have to promise me you can never kill ever again. And you basically see them go back to their normal life after that, with her thinking every time he like looks at the next door neighbor who's her friend, she gets suspicious, like, don't you think about trying to murder my best friend or anything like that. And then it shifts gears again at the end of the second act, when out of nowhere she pushes her husband over the stairway and then she murders him. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, again, I was not expecting that. And then, of course, in the third act is where Stephen Lang's character, who is featured prominently in the first two acts in the background, kind of watching over everything. And then, of course, he comes in. He lets her know that, oh, he knows that her husband is the killer. And now she's probably thinking, because she's thinking about her kids, because she wants to save her kids from that reputation that their dad is a serial killer. So she's thinking, I may have to kill this guy. But then when he has a heart attack, I think it was, like, then she goes to see him in the hospital, and then they have that chat, which is a great scene, by the way. And basically he tells her, like, you know what, you did the right thing. And also he tells her a secret that he's never told anyone about himself, that he let somebody die. And in a way, it's kind of like the shared secret between the two of them. And they basically, it's like they have a common ground with each other. So I just thought that was interesting on a narrative level. I could definitely see, like, being disappointed that it's not as intense or suspenseful as it could have been.
I don't think it needed to be, like, overly intense or suspenseful. Like, there's some very good scenes, like, as mentioned, like, that sort of near the end in the hospital. Like, that's a fantastic scene. It's well, like, I don't want to use the word executed, but the scene where she actually does murder the husband. And again, like you said, you're not really expecting that to happen when it happens. I think that's really well done as well. And of course, like her finding out the husband's secret, and then he kind of tells her he knows what the bloke, he knows, she knows, blah, blah, blah. Like some of like those scenes are like really good, really well done. I think it's a lot of the in-between that doesn't quite hit the right notes, but also at the end of the day, what's the message that it's trying to say? Like, is it okay to kill someone if you're like a Dexter type person, or is it okay in maybe extreme circumstances, or is everyone just a bit of a shit? Like it's, there's, you know, it's a better movie for all of this morality, and it's called I Saw the Devil, and I highly recommend it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, there's definitely some interesting aspects, and it does feel uneven because of that. But I think my biggest problem with the film, even though as good as Joan Allen, and I love Joan Allen, she's always great.
Oh, she's amazing. And it's not her. She's been in other Stephen King.
Yeah, we talked about Lisey's Story, which she's also in. And
too.
Yeah, but I think my biggest problem with this film is it feels like a TV movie, like visually and the way it's made. It feels like it could have been played on the Lifetime channel or as a Hallmark movie, like one of those My Stepdaughter's Stalker or something like that.
My husband's a murderer, coming to Hallmark tomorrow.
Exactly. Like, just give it that title and it could easily have been that. But I guess that's kind of my biggest problem is like, if it had a bit more mood and atmosphere, and it probably would have been even better. But I think that sort of TV feel kind of stops it from being a better film in that regard.
Well, yeah, because not only is, for me, was the script letting me down, but I wasn't even getting something for my eyes to look at, too. I was kind of forced to just deal with, let's face it, a really pedestrian looking film, but I also think kind of a pedestrian plotted film too. I think they were gonna try to do suspense, but it feels like a film with the scenes out of order, even though because of the information you have, the scene with Stephen Lang in the hospital wouldn't play, but it feels like a scene that should come before her final confrontation with her husband. It should end with her killing her husband, should it not? As well written as the hospital scene is, I don't know. It's just, I think if you're going to say Stephen King's A Good Marriage and your poster has a bloody handprint on his towel and hers are nice and neat, you go in with a certain mind.
You don't really pick up on any of like just what that sort of artwork reveals. Like, we don't technically see him with blood on his hands.
No, I mean, that was just that's your shorthand to say I married a.
Yeah, but I think it would have been interesting if we saw something like how you said, like, her side is neat, his isn't so neat. If we saw some kind of contrast, but they come off as very ordinary people. I mean, guess that's kind of the point of, like, oh, you never know who a serial killer could be. Again, it's done much better in a movie called Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
And I love the fact with the poster, though, Stephen King's name is actually bigger than the actual title of the film. If you look at the post.
Well, you got to sell that sizzle because, and again, not faulting anyone in front of the camera for it. The premise is great. I just think the execution is, it's too tame for, it could have been explosive. Even if it wasn't explosive in a more violent way, it could have been explosive in a more dramatic way. It, like, give me something. Everyone is like on snooze alert in this movie.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's like people are on snooze, you would think.
It's a low energy movie.
Even with trauma and whatnot, like, you expect a bit more of a bang out of a lot of these revelations and stuff, but it doesn't happen.
It's not there. No, it's not there.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Oh, well.
A good marriage does not a good movie make.
A good marriage might be a boring marriage, according to this movie. Well, your husband might be a serial killer.
Exactly. But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of a good marriage. Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on this film?
I mean, like I said, I did like it a little bit more on my second watch. It still has the problems it has. I think it is, I guess, anchored by that really strong performance from Joan Allen. And I think another actress, I don't think, would have been able to have pulled it off the way she kind of does. But at the end of the day, I think it's kind of a mid-tier King adaptation, and so many kind of are in that mid-tier, but it's certainly better than some. It's certainly worse than some. My rating has now gone to 3 out of 5. I don't think I want in on that marriage.
Scott, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Okay, out of 5, I got to give it 2. And that's on your, and those 2 stars are pretty much for Joan Allen, so.
I'm actually going to be pretty generous. I'm going to give it a 3. I think it, like I said, it does pretty much feel like a TV movie a lot of the time. But I do think that both the performances from Joan Allen and Abbie LaPaglia, I think, are pretty solid, particularly Joan Allen, who's always great. And I feel like this film really does hinge on her a lot, and she definitely elevates the film. But I also do like the fact that the script is very subversive in this type of story. Like putting things a lot earlier or giving things you're not expecting in a film like this. So even though, yes, it does feel like a TV movie, but it's not your typical kind of Lifetime thriller plot. Unless it's like Stalked by My Doctor, but that's a whole different story altogether. But and also it's got to give it a little shout out because Shawshank is mentioned.
I mean, in the film. You will usually get some kind of reference that puts everything in the same kind of universe.
Well, alrighty. Well, I guess we'll move on to our next film, which is the film that also came out in 2014 and released a few days later after A Good Marriage, and that, of course, is Mercy.
Your grandma, she's in pretty bad shape. The nursing home won't take care of her. She's gonna need us close, okay?
What's this?
That's a conjuring book. It's used for black magic. Folks say that it opens a doorway to something dark. And evil.
Grandma? Death's coming.
You can't save me.
Your grandmother. She sees things.
Isn't it possible that you imagined or dreamed all this?
Which was directed by Peter Cromwell, written by Matt Greenberg, who's a screenwriter we've actually mentioned before on this show, Marcy, because he also co-wrote 1408 and co-wrote the story to the Pet Sematary remake. So this is one of 3 Stephen King adaptations he's worked on, not unless you include his uncredited revisions on Children of the Corn 3, but you know, that's not really an adaptation. But also, it's based on the short story, Grandma, by Stephen King. This film stars Frances O'Connor, Shirley Knight, Chandler Riggs, Joel Courtney, Dylan McDermott, and Mark Duplass. And the plot summary for this film, which I'm reading off IMDb, is a single mum and her 2 boys help take care of their grandmother with mystical powers. Now, Marcy, we have recently talked about the short story that this film is based on, Grandma, on the recent episode of Podcasters of Horror, which the 80s version of the Twilight Zone did an adaptation of that story for one of their episodes. So now this story has been expanded into a full-length feature film. So what are your thoughts on Mercy?
Well, they did the story of Grandma a lot better in the 20 minutes of the Twilight Zone episode. Like, there is a way you can turn that into a full-length movie. This isn't it. I don't know what this was. I don't know what they were trying to go for. They completely wasted a pretty solid cast as well. And I don't know if it's because in the Grandma short from the Twilight Zone that Grandma was voiced by Piper Laurie. I just felt like Grandma should be a Piper Laurie type, and I didn't get that from this Grandma. I don't know what this Grandma was. The story doesn't really go anywhere. It doesn't really achieve anything. I did not enjoy this film. It was a bit of a slog to get through. I don't like being mean. I don't like shitting on movies. And it pains me to say that this is really not good. This is like very low tier Stephen King adaptation. This is like Children of the Corn, the recent one, kind of, this is really not good. I don't know what you've done with your source material to get to this point. You have Lovecraft elements, and like in that story, you kind of get the hint of it and stuff, but they don't really do much with that either. And it's a very dark movie. It is actually very hard to see what is going on with a lot of scenes. It just doesn't work. Not thinking about the actual story that it's based on, I don't think that works either at all. I don't know what they were trying to say with this film. I don't know what the point was. I really didn't think it was very good. And again, I don't like saying bad things about movies without saying anything decent. It's hard to find something good that was in the film. Like, again, they had a really good cast, but they felt really wasted. I think Chandler Rigg was a decent choice to play George in the film. I think he did fine. He's in most of the film. I think he carried it fine. He felt like a kid. But that's probably like one of the only nice things I have to say. And I apologize to everybody who made the movie.
Scott, your thoughts on Mercy?
Well, I certainly feel more at ease now after Marcy's review. I can breathe a little sigh of relief. I loved it. No, I'm kidding. It's not great. It's really not very good. But I did, if I put it in the context of this double feature, released 3 days apart, at least there's some energy to this. If I split them apart and look at them separately, yes, A Good Marriage is the better made film. It's the better acted film overall and whatnot. But Mercy has a lot of energy to it, but it's going in 6,000 different directions. I think there's a lot more movie here that was left on the floor because there are a lot of confusing moments in this movie. Subplots that wander off into the strip mall and you never see them again, and just there's stuff that doesn't make sense. It's 75 minutes long without credits. So, and again, I'm not familiar with the original story or I haven't seen the adaptation that Harlan Ellison wrote for The Twilight Zone either. So I can only judge this by this. I liked Shirley Knight as Grandma. Again, I can't compare to any other interpretation. I enjoyed her. I've always liked her work. And I thought Mark Duplass was really good as the drunk uncle. So the drunkle. And I wish he had been in like 80% more of the movie.
He's not in it much. And he probably is like the more notable sort of character that you get something out of.
He's got a pulse and some quirks, and he's interesting. The mom really doesn't really register too much for me, and I don't think it's the actress's fault. I just think it's not a particularly well-written character, as is much of it. Yeah, I couldn't recommend this movie to anyone. There's these disparate elements fighting each other, and in the end, everyone loses. So, yeah, there you go.
Where to start with my thoughts on Mercy? Now, Marcy, we've covered a lot of bad Stephen King adaptations of this on this show. Some of the ones I've really hated, but when we talked about, like, The Mangler, the Langoliers, and I'm not
starting to think that, like, sorry to cut you off, I think we are, like, in this minority who really don't like The Mangler, because I see a lot of love for that movie, and I don't get it.
If I may, yes. I don't love it, but I do like it because it's got some Tobe Hooper juice in it, and it has Robert Englund playing Foghorn Leghorn. So
I mean, that's always, I mean, he really is like an entertaining part of it. But I think the best thing I can say about The Mangler was when Bede and I watched it together, was all my Buffalo Bill imitations was the more entertaining part of the, watching the movie.
But
and I was gonna say, I was also just gonna add, when Ted Levine is in his own movie completely,
and I
love him for it. But no, it's not a good movie, but I like watching it.
Well, that's the thing though, with The Mangler, I can get why people like that movie. Like, I can totally get it. I don't get people who like The Langoliers. That's a whole completely different story.
Yes, no one should like that.
Yes. But Marcy, I'm not going to lie, and this is going to sound very controversial to me, I think Mercy may be the worst Stephen King adaptation I have seen.
It's certainly down there.
Wow.
The Langoliers, or The Longoliers, as I like to call it, that movie was 3 hours long. Mercy is 75 minutes long without credits, and somehow it felt longer than The Langoliers.
Well, looking at, I've got my letterbox list up. I've got Stephen King film adaptations.
Yeah.
I still put Children of the Corn, the recent one, right at the bottom, but Mercy is number two, and then the more recent Firestarter is down there. I actually have to find
the TV ones, yeah.
Yeah, because, like, where would I rank that there? But now I have to go, like, look at my list. Hold on. You can cut me looking this up
now. Oh, that's all right. That's all right.
Okay. So what did I rank The Langoliers? I can't remember. I think I gave it, like, one or one and a half. But, yeah, I think I would actually rather sit through 3 hours of The Langoliers than sit through 75 minutes of Mercy, because it offers me nothing. But as Scott said, like, it's got more energy, but it doesn't do really anything with it. Sorry, Bede, continue with your review.
But I think you're right too, Scott. I honestly think, because this movie started shooting in 2012 and didn't get released till 2014, I can imagine this, and this has big names behind it, because it's produced by Blumhouse, McGee produced it as well. So I can imagine this was going to be like a big theatrically released film, until they saw the final product and tried to salvage it, and probably cut so much out, because that the plot is so disjointed and all over the place.
It really is.
Like, when Mark Duplass's character died, I didn't realize that it was him until like 5 minutes later.
But it happens, and it's like, what?
But, and also, it's just so poorly made as well. Like, I think this film has a really good, solid cast in it, but they're just given nothing to do, and most of them are just really bad. Like, Frances O'Connor, who's an Australian actress who I love, she's not particularly good in this movie.
She's barely in it, and she's top billed, for God's sake. And the mother character, like, in the short story, which I was totally forgot, I was going to read it before we discussed the movie, but I didn't end up getting there, but we know this. It is told from the perspective of voiceover from Georgie, George, not the same George from It. So the mum doesn't really play a big role. And again, you see it in that Twilight Zone episode, the mum's only there at the beginning, the end. It's all told the voiceover. And they do add some voiceover to it, but it doesn't quite work.
Like, why?
But again, it's like this.
Slap it on at the end, this voiceover, and it's like, why start now?
But it also just doesn't really go anywhere. They didn't really flesh out any of the characters.
And also, Joel Courtney, who was the lead in Super 8 and has been in other stuff since, He's meant to be the older brother, but he plays that character like he's way younger than Chandler Bing's character. Like, his performance is weird in this movie. And also, I guess Mark Duplass, I didn't really care for Mark Duplass's performance in this film, but now that I think about it, maybe he's the only one who kind of knew exactly what film he was in.
And I think he knew what kind of movie this was. And I don't want to diss Shirley Knight, because I really like Shirley Knight. I don't think that she was grandma. Again, because I'm kind of picturing grandma as already being like decrepit and in bed and stuff, but she's at the start, we see her walking around and all that. And I just felt like it probably would have been more effective if we didn't get any of that and grandma was more of a mysterious figure, which, again, that they do that so well in the Twilight Zone. And we are talking a lot about the Twilight Zone grandma episode. The segment is available to watch on YouTube. So if you want to check it out, just look up the Twilight Zone grandma. G-R-A-M-A. Grandma. I highly recommend people check it out and listen to Podcasters of Horror, because we have a great deep dive discussion about it.
Well, I'm marking it down, that's for sure. I spent nearly 75 minutes trying to figure out who Dylan McDermott was in this movie.
I still don't know what his character,
to the family.
He wasn't related to anybody there. I was so fucking confused.
Well, that's the thing, Marcy, because the whole thing with Mercy, who Shirley Knight plays in the film.
Grandma's now called Mercy for some reason.
Yeah. She wanted to have kids, but she kept having miscarriages. Yeah. So she basically, even though she was this very religious woman, that she decided to turn to the dark side and basically go all Lovecraftian cosmic horror so that she could have children. And then, of course, her husband puts an axe to his face, which is like the probably one of the only good things about this movie, because I felt
he
like
he knew
that
how to get out early.
He knew how to get out of this movie early, but but I honestly thought at first Dylan McDermott was one of the three kids, and then I realized, oh, he's not one of the children.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. And, like, I didn't hate that kind of backstory stuff. Like, I think that's an interesting idea, like, kind of doing that deal with the devil to get what you want, the monkey's paw type of thing. Like, there's always consequences. Yeah. But we didn't dive into any of that. We don't know anything about why the kids really hate grandma now. Like, we don't know what happened. Obviously, she didn't give a shit. The husband axed himself, really, ultimately. So we didn't, like, all of this could have been developed and we could have had something very interesting go into that more Lovecraftian horror that King absolutely loves to play with. And you, like I said, you get hints of that with the short story. But again, what the fuck was they doing with this movie?
It's all over the place. It's very self-serious. And I think that's another thing too. Like,
it's too serious, right?
Yeah. Like, I've been watching a lot of these really crappy, low-budget British horror movies lately. Don't ask me why. Like,
I don't ask. I don't question why you do things.
Like films like Mother Krampus and other stuff like that. And they kind of like have these ridiculous premises and they play them so serious. This is the tone. This film has the exact same tone as those films. And I'm like, lighten up.
Lighten the fuck up, actually. Get some more lighting on set. Why is this film so fucking dumb?
Literally lighten up.
But the part that made me laugh out loud the most is when basically Chandler Briggs' character, George, and his brother Buddy, they find the book that
yes.
And then, of course, he has to like cry into the book for it to show like what happened. Like, because it's like, it also explains, like, it's the weeping book. If you want to read what's on the pages, you gotta cry what you want onto the page. So you can... it's so stupid. But what made me laugh so hard was Buddy is like, okay, read the book. And then he freaks out, grabs the book, throws it in the wood chipper, and then all of a sudden, a part of the book goes flying and hits him in the chest.
I know. Look, I know Fargo's a great movie and the wood chipper scene is hilarious, but again, this isn't it. You want a wood chipper scene? Go watch Fargo.
We have to get Buddy to the hospital somehow, I guess, eh?
Well, that's the thing. The last 20 minutes of this movie, or the last 15, essentially is the short story. It's just like all the build up to, because even I had to laugh, because the whole point of the short story, from what I've heard, is Georgie is scared of Grandma. So before his mum and brother go off to the hospital, and I'm thinking like, buddy, where that shard of your book hit you, you should be dead by now. It's like in your heart.
Why was it like a glass shard when it's a book?
I don't know, but...
Ah, there's a book in my chest!
It's a hardcover.
Marcy, to do
super
it to
super hardcover.
Marcy, he took reading to heart, okay? But so, and then when they're about to drive off and leave George, George is like, I'm scared. And then, of course, it goes into the short story. And then, of course, there's other things as well. Like there's a death wolf in this movie.
Yeah, what the fuck was that? Wolf. It's never explained. It shows up like twice.
Your facial expression right now, Scott, says everything about this.
It does.
It reminded me of Devil Dog, the Hound from Hell, with Richard Crenna and Kim Richards, or Kyle Richards, one of the Richards sisters.
Yes.
Which was a Charles Band production, and it looked like...
I mean, I love Charles Band productions.
It looked like Paul Stanley from Kiss, but with like a dog's face and glowing eyes, much like our Death Wolf in this movie, who might as well have been a Langolier, for all I care, and for all its effectiveness. Like, why?
Like I said, I'd rather watch 3 hours of the Langoliers. At least I can, at minimum, enjoy whatever performance Bronson Pinchot does in that movie. That miniseries, rather.
Where I literally, and again, I am a pacifist. I'm a peaceful man. The little girl ghost man. Oh. I can't do any more of those. I can't.
Even was that? Who was the little girl ghost? Who killed
Grandma.
Her? Why is she a ghost?
It was Grandma.
Oh, for fuck's sake. See, I paid so much attention. Why was it Grandma's girl ghost?
Why was he seeing
Grandma's
ghost?
I don't know. At
ghost?
The end, she sees her for the last time, and she says, I love you too, George. And he says, Grandma? And she goes, just so you're
I don't think I paid attention to that. And then that doesn't make any sense.
No, doesn't make any sense at all.
What? Okay, so it was Grandma, all well and good, but why the fuck is he seeing kid version of Grandma through the whole film? Why is he talking to what he says was the neighbor's kid or some shit?
You know why, Marcy? Because scenes were cut out of this movie. That's what I reckon.
Maybe, but again, like, yeah, I'd fuck this movie.
I think movies were cut out of this movie.
Yes.
Mercy is too close to Marcy, and I don't like that. I don't want this taint near me. No.
Although I had to laugh even more so, because there is another reference to the largest Stephen King universe in this book, is that when they take Grandma to the old person's home, it's called R.L. Flagg Home.
Home of the Aged, yeah. That's a good joke. I'll take it. Listen.
Just reminds me of something I could be watching. That's better. So I feel bad just completely shitting on this movie. Like, if they plan to make something and they thought it was good, I don't know. I really don't know. There's not a lot like you can find out about the film, but I don't know. Like, I'm a believer that if you want to adapt something, you keep the core elements and you... Like, I don't think you can adapt something fully and be fully faithful. So I think you need to have the core of what's there, but expand upon it in your own different way. But I don't feel like they did this at all. It's like, oh, okay, a creepy grandmother. Let's just go with that. Like, what the fuck? Why did you add all these weird things that don't make any sense?
Because they needed to fill out the runny time, Marcy.
Like, I would have been fine watching a film with a kid left at home with grandma for 90 minutes if it was interesting. But this just did all the sorts of things that it didn't need to do. None of it makes any bloody sense. And by the end, you're so tapped out, you don't realize the little girl was grandma for some fucking reason.
And also, don't forget there is a subplot where one of the other kids is in an insane asylum and broke out toward Georgie, but then by the time he gets to her, she's like dead already. So
yes. Yeah,
no. What's great is Georgie's mom phones her sister, who somehow stole a cell phone. So she phones her on this stolen cell phone to try to contact her after she's escaped from the mental institution. Like, oh my God. And then Georgie meets her out in the middle of a field just so he can have a scene with his aunt. Oh, like.
I don't know.
When I got to the second movie that you put me on these two movies together, having seen neither one of them, when I got about half an hour, or no, I'll be honest, 10 minutes into Mercy, I thought, okay, you've given me a couple of giant logs that I'm supposed to be dancing with here. So that's fine. It makes for entertainment. Yeah, if I was to rate this, I would give it the same 2 out of 5, but it would be a different 2 out of 5, maybe a slightly more entertaining 2 out of 5.
I was going to say, if it's a 2, it's a toilet number 2. That's a terrible joke, Marcy.
They're both number 2s. No, that's fine. We can go with that. They're both number 2s in my heart.
So. But, well, since you gave us your final thoughts and rating, Scott, Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on this movie?
1, I obviously didn't pay much attention to this movie because there wasn't much to pay attention to out of 5. I do not recommend it. I do recommend watching the short Grandma. And Grandma, the short story it's collected in, I'm trying to remember the bloody short story, Skeleton Crew.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's in Skeleton Crew, which I have a copy of. So read the short story. I'm going to do that now. I need to cleanse myself from that movie.
Indeed. Well, Marcy, I'm going to give it the lowest of the lows when it comes to ratings. I'm giving it 0.5 star, which is a rating I don't really give out that much to movies. I've only given maybe at least nearly 100 movies that rating.
At least nearly 100 movies. Bloody hell.
Well, to be fair, Marcy, I've logged in like nearly 1,100 movies on Letterboxd.
Fair enough.
11,000 movies, so.
I mean, look, if I looked at my Letterboxd rating, I've got a lot more have higher ratings than lower ratings, so. Even, look, it takes a lot for me to give something like a 1.5 or a 1.
Mm.
So you won't see that too often with films. If it goes that low, it's really not good because I try to find something good in everything and I couldn't.
Same here, and yeah, it's just, it's so poorly made. It's all over the place. It's way too serious. The performances are very lackluster. And it's just not scary. It's confusing. It's just a grand old mess of a film. And it's just a complete slog because of it. And I just got to say, Dylan McDermott, if you're listening to this podcast right now, please stop being in horror films set on farms. I demand it. You were in the messages. That was bad. Please, this is your second time in a very similar film. Please don't do any more.
I will say, make sure somebody thoroughly reads the script first, buddy.
Exactly.
I will say this before we wrap up. I'm just looking at my Letterboxd ratings. I have not literally logged every single thing I've ever watched, but movies that I consider worse than this. 2069, A Sex Odyssey, and I somehow think I might actually would rather watch that than Mercy. One I definitely would, I'd rather watch Mercy over that would be Plug, which is an infamous Ozploitation film.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Jingles, got the 0.5 star, the original Reefer Madness, because it's bullshit propaganda, obviously. Ghost Can't Do It, and we know why. The Monster High movie, which I absolutely fucking hated. And a bunch of Uwe Boll movies and Baby Geniuses. So there you go. Mercy is in that company right now.
Oh, boy.
Well, I know. But I guess that could be a wrap on this episode of the King Zone podcast. Thank you very much, Marcy, for being an awesome co-host as per usual.
You're welcome.
And also, thank you, Scott, for coming on the show. And I am deeply sorry for the trauma you've experienced watching these movies.
Listen, I will get out of it. As Mr. King himself says there's no such thing as a bad horror movie, so
he hasn't
except
seen...
these two.
I was going to say he hasn't seen Mercy yet, so.
No, it's, you know what, it's fine. I'll survive. And thank you so much for having me on the show, regardless.
Well, we're very happy that you were able to come on the show, and not just to talk about these films, but also talk about your book as well. But I guess before we finish up the episode today, Scott, where can people find you on the internet this weekend and also some other work you would like to plug as well?
Oh, boy. Well, the only work I'm plugging right now is a cut below. That is what I'm tap dancing for. That is my focus, my sole focus. And you can find me blabbing about it everywhere from that old strip mall known as Twitter at Phantasm2. And then you can find me on Blue Sky, sdrebbit.bluesky. Whatever the blue sky is. And I'm on the Insta, and I'm trying to get on TikTok. That's hard on the hips. So, yeah, you can find me everywhere. And please, everyone, reach out. I love to talk about horror and movies and books with everyone. So, please, reach out.
Awesome. And, Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week? And also yourself, too.
Yes, of course. Yes, the home of the King Zone podcast is supermarcy.com, which is, well, it's supermarcy.com, but it is known as the Super Network because me and Bede are a network. We have the King Zone and many other podcasts under our banner, which can all be found there. And if you are listening to this on the website or something else, or you want to listen to it on a different podcast platform, just look up the King Zone podcast and follow and like and all that jazz there. And check out the link tree for the Super Network to find all your links relating to the Super Network and our podcasts. And my personal podcast is After Dark with Super Marcy, an adults-only podcast. You can hear me talk about all strange things that happen after dark. Take that as you will. Again, you can just look it up and find me on the socials. And yeah, pretty much my personal socials, I promote everything on there anyway. I am Super Marcy everywhere on Letterboxd. I am Super_Marcy, and you can enjoy previews of what we'll be discussing on podcasts as I log the films I'm watching. And sometimes I might just have a random Rocky marathon, so you can see that there too.
And if people want to find me personally out there on the internet, you can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jemide as one word. You can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com. And of course, you can find all the podcasts that I co-host with you, Marcy, all the other shows outside of the King Zone podcast on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Super Network podcast feed. And for my solo shows, Bede versus the Living Dead, and as well as its spin-off show, Bede and Steve versus Camp Crystal Lake, you can find those on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bede versus the Living Dead podcast feed. So, yep, that is a wrap for this episode of the King Zone podcast. We hope you all enjoyed this one, everyone. And we'll see you all next time in the zone. See you, everybody. Bye.
Oh, Mrs. Anderson.
Yes. Can I help you?
Yeah.
Oops.
Oh, well, thank you. Holt Ramsey, I'm with the Office of the State's Attorney General.
Does RET mean you're retired?
Well, I'm an old dog. They toss me a bone now and then I chew on it.
Oh. I think I've seen you. Have you been here before?
According to the Hindus, we all have.
Yes. What can I do for you, Mr. Ramsey?
Inside would be better.